I'm going to read this paper as well, although at times when I show slides, I will diverge from it slightly. And we're going to have a short film to begin with, because I'm going to be talking about a particular work of Nancy Spiro's that is actually not in the exhibition. So we have a short 4-minute clip of her making an installation. We have in England something called the Peter Principle, which is if anything can go wrong, with technology it will. Ah.
Okay. Anna Medieta came through a closed door. She opened it. This was 1982 at Franklin Furnace Performance Space. She walked to the roll of the Santeria drums, walked over to the wall where a piece of paper was pinned to it. She dipped her hand in a bowl which had been placed at the side of the paper. The bowl was either filled with blood or paint of a bloody color, or a mixture of both. She put her hands in it, put her hands then up on the wall, brought them down, and her body kind of falling with her hands. The drums kept rolling on the record. She turned around, walked through the door, closed it, and that was the end of the performance. Finish. A very brief and powerful performance. I've always remembered this performance, and I recreated it for the first time in Wuppertal, Germany, at the museum, at the Von der Heydt Museum, Wuppertal, in 1991, in a group show. And then subsequently, I did it at the Whitney Biennale in New York in 1993, and I am doing it now for the third time at the Aldrich Museum. I want to perpetuate Anna's memory as the powerful artist that she was, and this is a commemorative act on my part, because I write across it. When I bring my hands down, then I dip a brush into paint, another color, and I say homage to Anna Mendieta. And this is my homage to her. I want her name remembered, which I know it will be. And her work to me was very meaningful. And so, in a way, I would like, through my actions, to keep it alive. And this is not just a mere act of let's say imitation, but it is a recreation, and it always creates kind of a very powerful emotional feeling in myself of remembrance and of the power of the Santeria drums that we're playing, and just the intensity of the whole experience.
Start with a quote. At their word, the word which tortures the spirit, the sick woman was turned into a corpse. The corpse was hung from a stake. This appears on a painting of Nancy Spiro's, which is in the exhibition. It's one from the what's called the Black Paris paintings mostly that were made in the period when she and Leon Golub and the family were in Paris from 1959 to 64. And this painting is titled At Their Word, The Sick Woman, and is dated actually 1957-58. The quote is Sumerian. Nancy's not quite sure, but she thinks it may have been given to her initially by her husband, the artist Leon Golub. Sumerian culture has very little to say about women. This quote, though, seems to me a very interesting place to start, because it introduces the key themes of Nancy Spiro's work: language, the feminine, violence, and the body. It's also extraordinarily prescient of the work that she made 50 years later, and which closes this current exhibition, Maypole Take No Prisoners. Though now the emotional register describes a riotous anger at yet another act of male imperial aggression, the invasion of Iraq. and we mess with these grotesque and malignant heads at our peril. But I'm getting ahead of my story. My talk is called Spiro's Touch. For me, talking or writing about the art of Nancy Spiro, or her husband, the artist Leon Golub, will always carry an autobiographical charge. Because of them, I first visited New York in the early 1980s, and they were my entree into the New York art world. Many of the artists, writers, galleries, and curators I've worked with over the years came through introductions made by Leon and Nancy. In fact, through their generous hospitality, their studio apartment in Soho became something of a second home. It was there that, having breakfast with Leon on the morning of September the 11th, 2001, we heard the first plane pass directly overhead, watched the second plane hit the South Tower, and lived together through those world-altering days. My voice, then, in the conversations that constitute the discourse on both artists, is partial and committed, and this talk will, without apology, blend the personal with the factual and the interpretive as I offer some thoughts on the work of Nancy Spiro. Recently, writing and thinking about art, I found myself increasingly drawn to consider the processes of making as offering important insights into the resulting work. That is, what happens not only in the studio, but in the complex build-up and preparation to the work of the work of art. Let me be clear. I'm not talking about a sociology of the creative process, nor its psychopathology, nor wanting to overprivilege intention, although I do share the philosopher Richard Bolheim's belief in the necessary connection between artistic intention and meaning. And although art sociality is a given, I am skeptical of the insights offered by sociology of art. Perhaps what I am getting at is how to prize open the work of art's self-sufficiency. What sets it apart from other things in the world after what can be known has been accounted for, with the proviso that accounting for what can be known is a lot, and not all works repay such scrutiny. So, to begin at the beginning. I first encountered the art of Nancy Spiro over a quarter of a century ago at the Institute for Contemporary Arts in London. The year was 1980. The exhibition, one of three feminist shows held concurrently, Women's Images of Men, About Time, which included contemporary film, photographic and video work, and Issues, which was created by the American critic Lucy Lippard. This was after the formative period of the women's movement and marked the intrusion into and displacement of traditional cultural forms, practices and institutions by an expanding and explorative politics of gender. These three exhibitions marked the public recognition in London of the demands and priorities of a feminist voice across the cultural arena, and also in their variety and depth, marked the shift from an emphasis upon the representation of a new politics to a more theoretically inflected politics of representation. Lucy Lippard's selection of over 20 international artists and groups with a specifically political agenda included the diversity of these positions and introduced a great deal of new work to a London audience. She had selected Spiro's two panel gouache and collage. Slides, please. Lucy Lippard had selected Spiro's two panel gouache and collage on paper work from 1974, Torture in Chile. Next slide, please. The upper half comprised large lettered text, closely printed, recounting the torture of women in the prisons of the Pinochet Junta, excerpted from the documents of Amnesty International. Each word was carefully formed from the wooden alphabets that Spiro had collected over the years, the overall effect being one of tonal variety due to the uneven pressure exerted in the hand printing process. Next slide, please. And the next. The lower half depicted repeated heads in profile, some with familiar protruding tongue, which first appeared in the Arto works. I mean, these, in fact, are literally about this high. So they're very small heads. These were widely spaced and placed on and within an open grid or frame composed of vertical, horizontal and diagonal lines. One section included an inverted female figure. Next, please. An inverted female figure, and the right-hand panel ends with another image from the Codex, a three-headed serpent. Much of this I came to know intimately over the years. But at the time, what registered was the impact of the relentless textual narrative, contrasted with the fragmented visual imagery, and what I took to be the artist's appropriation of conceptual art's linguistic emphasis, but here utilized for a re-engagement with the world of political and military realities. Of course, I little realized at the time that I was encountering an artist's practice that was to become both a cause and something of a lifetime's obsession. Sandy Nairn, at the time the Director of Visual Arts at the ICA, who had overseen the three exhibitions, also shared my interest in Nancy's partner, the artist Leon Golub, which led 2 years later to my involvement in Leon's first London show for 25 years, my first meeting with both artists, and the invitation to come to New York. I went the following year, intending to study Golub's painting in depth and, almost out of curiosity, rather than real interest, asked Nancy if I could see more of her work. As she unrolled scroll after scroll across the studio floor, I was initially astonished, then intrigued, and finally overwhelmed, and I returned to London determined that this work demanded an audience. I curated Nancy's first retrospective at the ICA in 1987. My enthusiasm was rapidly confirmed as she was offered shows in New York, followed by the growing international recognition of her significance and necessity. 20 years on, and I'm still as delighted, shocked, and engaged with an artist who continues to be as inventive, playful, risk-taking, and creative as when she first took the decision to abandon painting for print and collage and to make the representation of the feminine across histories and cultures the subject of her practice. Can we have the next slide, please? In an early video made by Patsy Scala of Nancy Spiro at work in her New York studio, it's made in 1973. I don't think it's showing here, unfortunately, but we see her laying out sections of her scroll, Codex Artaud, across wooden floorboards. The camera slowly scans the images and text scattered over the loosely unfurled handmade paper sheets, which curl at their edges while, occasionally, a slight breeze lifts an end and creates undulations over the surface, all of which accidentally emphasizes the lightness and fragility of the work, contrasting with its formal and conceptual strength. On the soundtrack, son Philip Golub reads one of Artaud's letters to Jacques Rivière, whilst Nancy listens and writes phrases onto scraps of paper. The proximity of the camera to the work, despite the poor visual quality of the image, it's all slightly out of focus, very much handheld, suggests to the viewer the handcrafted collage nature of the Codex. This is one of the Codex panels. This is Codex Artaud, panel 6, 1971. As she recounts her procedures, the camera follows her hand, already showing the signs of the rheumatoid arthritis that was to possess her body over the coming years, inscribing the ferocious language of Artaud, a metonymic expression of her own angry sense of exclusion from the New York art world. This short video concludes with her rewinding the scrolls around a large cardboard tube. It's all very hands-on and personal. There are no assistants, no large-scale production of the backgrounds and figures that would come to compose her image bank. None of the activity that later enlivened the studio and home in New York. But there is a strong sense of process and of the temporal dimension of works that could take years to reach their final form. And of something almost secretive, the rolling and unrolling of each scroll, an action of disclosure and concealment, a characteristic of women artists' practice in the early feminist period. Well, over the years, things have changed, and Spiro's work has immeasurably increased in visibility, most evidently entering the public domain through her shift into direct printing onto the surface of walls, doors, even roofs and ceilings, as architecture became the ground for her ever-growing numbers of female figures to dance and cavort over. A visual lexicon constructed from the histories and mythologies of past and present cultures. But accompanying her move from the relative privacy of a visual symbolic language shared with family and friends, and firstly with Leon Golub, who for over 50 years was her ever-present companion and fellow artist, to the domain of galleries, museums and art world recognition. It was the assault upon the body, born with fortitude and a wry humour, that invaded every action and every day and every night reminder of the body's materiality, that we are all, in the end, just flesh and bones. I was forcefully reminded of this again 3 years ago, while observing Nancy directing her assistants and helpers after another prolonged period of hospitalisation in the arrangement and printing of a wall installation at the Drawing Centre on Worcester Street, Soho, New York. Hers has been a collaborative practice for many years, a choice which reflects both the politics, which has its origins in the women's movement, and a necessity, as it became increasingly difficult, and for difficult read painful, for her to physically control the actual printing. Since her first installation, Waterworks, set in a water filtration plant in Toronto in 1988, the filmmaker Irene Souza has documented the design, production and realisation of many of her temporary and permanent installations throughout Europe and North America. For example, her film of the making of works for Smith College, Massachusetts in 1990 records the artist holding rubber plates against walls to determine the specific placing of a figure, and in close discussion with her longtime assistant, the artist Sam Kunz. Can we have the next slide, please? Another section shows the installation of Minerva, Sky Goddess, on the roof of the Circulo de Bellas Artes in Madrid in 1991. And the next one, please. With assistants inking plates, placing them against wall and floor surfaces, and then printing the image through the pressure of a roller on the rubber. This tells us a lot, but also inevitably misses more. What persistently evades both the fictional and the factual portrayal of artists is the intricacy, rigour, attentiveness to detail and facture that characterises individual practice and the relationship between artist and assistant. This is a complex event, which inevitably touches upon questions of authorship. The long history of gesture and trace as the genesis and primary signifier of artistic intention and identity is, as it were, placed in parenthesis by working practices that favour concept and process over action and expressivity, a connection that carries the memory of the Duchampian ready-made as the paradigmatic performative act of modernist aesthetics. In this respect, Nancy Spiro's installations are performative events. However, watching her attentive engagement and directorship of the realization of each printed image, there can be no doubt over her authority in determining both the overall structure and the detailed relationships of part to part and part to whole. Nothing is left to chance. She wants it just so, precisely and definitively, and whose hand leaves the final impress is secondary to the effectiveness of the dialogue between instructor and maker. It's a matter of interpretation and translation, and an exercise in a very particular form of communication, which, perhaps, alludes more to film and the character of the mise-en-scene as the mark of directorial sensibility. I wrote about this in my essay for the Fiden Monograph. It's in the bookshop, attached to the museum. Working again with Ivana Blaswick, who was then the initiator and editor of the Fiden series, we had ample opportunity during an extended period in New York to observe and frequently become implicated in the day-to-day activity of the studio as the productive site for both Golub and Spiro. However, there was always a distinct separation between the diurnal and the nocturnal patterns of studio life. Throughout the day, the studio functioned as the site of collective and occasionally frenzied action, which, alongside the daily domestic tasks, included the selection of images and their preparation via drawing or transcribing for the manufacture of the zinc or rubber plates, the printing of backgrounds and images to be cut out and stockpiled, works being dispatched to exhibition or storage, business and administration, accompanied and frequently interrupted by a constant stream of visitors requiring attention, making demands and providing services. And all of this revolving around the core of creative practice, like a spinning wheel, or the flows and eddies of a fast-flowing river breaking and swirling in the cross-currents. As I then described it, the studio is a location of a form of artistic production that is essentially performative. It is spatial, durational and staged, a series of discrete actions that together constitute a history of the work. A procedure is established, a ritual marked by the rhythm of bodies interacting in the process from conception to realization. The process itself is intertextual. From the initial stages of fabrication flow any number of visual narratives. The final phase, the positioning of figure on ground, always happened at night, completed during the periods of quiet and relative solitude. Nancy on her side of the studio, Leon on his, but both straying into each other's space to comment and discuss progress. I'll digress slightly because when I first went to New York, they very kindly allowed me to stay there, and on many subsequent visits I stayed. The thing that one has to realize with both Leon and Nancy is that they are creatures of the night. Partly this was necessity. Nancy, as the mother of three children, discovered that the most productive time for her was to actually work at night after the kids had gone to bed. And Leon, being Leon, wanted to accompany her, so he also worked at night. So occasionally when I'd stay there, and we'd have work to do, either I was writing about her or making an exhibition, we'd go out to dinner and we'd come back, and it would maybe be 11:30 or 12 o'clock, and they were lively as two spring chickens. They were raring to go. I wanted to go to bed and sleep. But actually, this is the time when the work happened. It's a very important part of knowing about Leon and Nancy. There is, I think, something central to Nancy's practice that connects with the contingencies and discordances of studio life, as I've described it. Concurrent with the Drawing Center installation was her exhibition at Long Gallery, where the temporal dimension was very much in play, not simply and obviously the real time of viewing such an extended work, but the times past and present that configured its conceptual and memorial domain. Can we have the next slide, please? This work, which isn't in the exhibition, is called Cri de Coeur, and was made in the immediate aftermath of the death of Leon, and after another prolonged period of hospitalization. The hand-printed paper panels were positioned at the join of wall and floor, wrapping around the entire space of the large gallery. Next one, please. And the next. Wrapping around the entire space of the large gallery, a somber unfolding of mourning women set against backgrounds that fade from darkness to light. The rectangular format interrupted by passages of silhouetted figures starkly outlined against the walls. You can see here some are actually cut out, here printed directly onto the paper. Once again, one of her scrolls usurped the familiar viewing relation, as the viewer was required to cast their eyes down upon a work that demanded close attention and an awareness of the body, bending or squatting to distinguish figure from ground, and the complexities of overprinting, veiling, and repetition. Can we have the next slide, please? And the next one. In 1991, Nancy Spiro was invited to contribute to an exhibition at the von der Heydt Museum, Wuppertal, Germany. This was a group show, but Spiro was given her own room, a much larger space than she had anticipated when planning and preparing for a single installation in her New York studio, the first enactment of her much-repeated work, The Ballad of Mary Sanders, The Jew's Whore. And the next one, please. Possessing only the materials for the one work, she decided to construct a new installation, one which didn't require any of the plates that were the basis for printing all of her imagery. Spiro had been present some years earlier, probably the early 1980s, when the artist Anna Mendieta had performed a version of Body Tracks in the basement of the Franklin Ferdinand Gallery in New York. Confronted with the extra space in Wuppertal, and possibly responding to the oppressive brutality of the image of the bound woman and the Bertolt Brecht poem that composed Mary Sanders, the thought occurred to her to perform her own version of the Mendieta work as a work of mourning and memorialization. Next slide, please. Her assistant, Sam Kuntz, inked her own hands and, under Spiro's direction, held them vertically above her head, then pressed her palms against the wall and dragged them downwards to create two runways of streaked red paint, fading irregularly towards the floor, the imprint slightly more pronounced on the right and picking up colour and definition at the base. The hand-inscribed text, Homage to Anna Mendieta, runs from left to right about a third of a distance from the base and rising slightly towards the right. Next slide, please. 2 years later, Spiro repeated Homage as part of her installation for the Whitney Biennial. Only this time, she performed the whole work herself. Whereas the Wuppertal work clearly shows the print of each hand pressed hard against the surface, followed by a downwards movement gaining momentum towards the floor, in the Whitney installation, the streaking starts at the top and the action is one of continuous movement from top to bottom. She also held her raised hands apart, suggesting a cruciform gesture, so the trace begins at an angle to the body, arcing downwards and quickening towards the base, rather than the straight up and down linearity. And the trace of the right hand breaks abruptly to the right towards the base. As in Wuppertal, the Whitney text bisects both arms, though at a slightly lower point, maybe two-fifths up from the floor. If you can kind of have in mind the film, that the little DVD I showed at the beginning. Why make so much of this, of what was, compared with most of her other installations, a relatively minor work? A number of reasons. Although Spiro is frequently quite specific in locating the sources for works, in particular historical and contemporary figures and events, in this case, the subject, Anna Mendieta, was a close friend. Here the anger and loss was neither mediated nor displaced, but directly experienced. Then, over the years of making installations, as I've already indicated, Spiro was the director rather than the performer. It is her assistants who do the actual printing. Perhaps the analogy with music is appropriate. The artist as conductor of her own score, controlling the musical rendition of each composition. Now, however, for the Whitney installation, we have the artist herself as performer. It was the impress of her paint-covered body making the image. Furthermore, she evokes specific art historical precedents, most obviously the Anthropometries of Yves Klein, and it's worth recalling that during their 5-year stay in Paris, Leon Golub exhibited at Klein's gallery, Iris Clert, and also, of course, Viennese actionism. But also, given her feminist politics, she alludes to the rhetoric of gesture and masculinity, so strongly identified with the generation of abstract expressionist painters, and that she had earlier lampooned in her own painting. Next slide, please. Homage to New York, I Do Not Challenge, 1958. This is also in the exhibition upstairs. The initials running down here refer to the initials of the major post-war abstract expressionist painters. More specific allusions might include the handprints in the paintings of Jackson Pollock, for example, running along the top edge of number 1, 1948, and, given Spiro's interest in ancient myths, the widespread proliferation of handprints in Paleolithic cave paintings, which are both an index of presence, but also, at some developmental point, an image. But Spiro's primary intention was neither genealogical, celebratory, or formalistic, but an expression of the body's tactility and mortality. Golub and Spiro knew Anna Mendieta and her partner, the artist Carl André, very well, and they had all dined together on the evening of September the 7th, 1985. Later that night, Mendieta fell to her death from the 34th floor of the apartment she shared with André, just around the corner from the Golubs. The resulting investigation and court case into the cause of her death split the New York art world, and Mendieta's work subsequently dropped from visibility until the critical tide around her practice began to shift in the mid-1990s. Mendieta, who was born in Cuba in 1948 but was sent by her parents to the US in 1961, had graduated from the University of Iowa in the early 1970s. And in 1973 in Mexico, she created a number of works in which she ritualistically performed scenes of violence against women using blood, feathers and other materials. In 1974, she made the work that Spiro was later to restage, untitled Blood Sign Number 2, Body Tracks. Can we run through the series of images of this performance? This is Mendieta performing this work, dipping her arms into a bucket of blood and pressing against white paper pinned to the wall of the intermediate studio, then dragging them against the paper down to the floor. Over the next few months, Mendieta repeated this performance a number of times, varying the media, red tempera, and the support, red, white, and lavender fabric. Her performance at the University of Iowa, in fact, was a blueprint for Spiro. Mendieta eventually moved to New York in 1978 and immediately became acquainted with the group who had founded AIR, which stands for Artists in Residence, the first gallery in New York to be run by women artists for women artists. Nancy Spiro was a founder member of AIR, and she invited Mendieta to become a member, and for some years, it was the primary exhibiting space for both artists. Spiro's reenactment 6 years after the death of Mendieta marked the start of her reassessment, and the following year, the inauguration of the Soho branch of the Guggenheim Museum was picketed by a 500-member demonstration of the Women's Action Coalition, which included Nancy Spiro, carrying placards with the slogan, "Where is Anna Mendieta?" The year after, 1993, Spiro made homage to Anna Mendieta in New York. The connections between the two artists go well beyond the ties of friendship and loyalty to shared thematic concerns that run through their artistic practices. The body, of course, and the promise of an autonomous female selfhood independent from the libidinous and vengeful desires of patriarchal societies. Myth and ritual, for Mendieta, a Catholicism inflected with the sacrifice of Santeria, the Cuban form of voodoo. For Spiro, her Jewishness and cross-cultural myths of the goddess. Their respective feminisms, Mendieta with her fascination with the symbiotic relation of the erotic with the death drive, found in the transgressive texts of Georges Bataille. For Spiro, her interest in the literary and psychoanalytic writings of Julia Kristeva, Luz Erigaray, and Hélène Cixous, who has in fact contributed an essay to the catalog, and who Spiro quoted in her installation, Let the Priest Tremble, which was originally made for the Icon Gallery Birmingham in 1998, and partly reproduced here. Can we have the next? This is the original installation of the work that Sam and her assistants recreated here. This is in the Icon Gallery in Birmingham. It was the reopening of this gallery, and this was the first exhibition. And the next, a detail. This is actually, again, a slight digression. There's a very nice, very amusing story about this piece. It was commissioned and installed, and it coincided with one of the G8 summits. In fact, I think there's a G8 summit going on at the moment, isn't there? This was a previous G8 summit. So the leaders of the major economic nations were going to come to Birmingham. The then director of the Icon Gallery, who was incredibly successful at getting interest and funding and sponsorship for her projects, managed to persuade the publicity departments or the press or the public relations departments working for the G8 that the wives of the leaders should have a dinner party in the Icon Gallery. This was all terrific stuff. It was going very well until I think either the night before or maybe a couple of days before, when a couple of the representatives turned up and saw the installation. And they thought that maybe, given this was going to be covered by the world's press, photographs of Mrs. Clinton et al. With Let the Priest Tremble and Too Bad If They See Our Sex is not probably the best idea. So unfortunately, the dinner was cancelled. It never took place. Anyway, to continue. However, for me, there is another connection, one that I've already mentioned. The figuring of the tactile evoking the body in all its corporeality. The self's encounter with the world as, in Merleau-Ponty's expression, touching and being touched. The quality that Spirio identifies that, for her, weaves through the variety and range of her practice is touch. However, getting at the precise meaning of touch, and even the artist becomes vague when pushed on this, is far from straightforward. Possibly there is no single identifiable attribute that fulfills the condition of a definition. And anyway, in some areas of the visual, language just breaks down. As writers, we search for equivalents, analogies, metaphors, any linguistic device that might help narrow the gap between seeing and saying, between observation, description, and interpretation. As fast as we impose our meanings, so something slips away. Seeing as if through a glass, darkly, but seldom face to face. An art historian's approach might be to simply settle for the catch-all tag, signature style. The pictorial characteristics that cohere and enable the identification of works. Artist name, when executed, period, relation to other works in the series. And Spiro does work in series. Repetition is one uncontestable aspect of her practice. And other such elements, beyond the obvious facts, in her case, of collage, spatial extension, and a lexicon of images now numbering over 500. But the tactile resides in the body, not in formal or technical procedures, but in the process of making, of putting things together, manipulating the prima materia, facture. For the philosopher Merleau-Ponty, the senses are to some extent transposable. We talk about the colour of a sound or the weight of a voice. And, quotes, the body is the fabric into which all objects are woven, and it is, at least in relation to the perceived world, the general instrument of our comprehension. However, touch is the most complex of the senses, a composite of functions which range from an instinctual response to contact, which covers the whole experiential range from pleasure to pain, to the body's knowledge of the contours and the textures of the material world. In fact, touch has been a defining characteristic of much of the art made by women over the past four decades. As the writer Peggy Phelan observed, quote, one of the revolutionary legacies of feminist art concerns the epistemological contours of touch itself. A legacy, as she goes on to assert, that includes issues of pleasure, power, historical lineage, trauma, and ethics. End quote. During the 1970s, performance, both live and recorded, was the primary medium through which feminist artists explored the politics of the body. Perhaps in relation to Spiro, touch makes manifest the density of experience. In his remarkable and sustained diaristic narrative of returning day after day to the same two paintings, the historian T.J. Clark has this to say about Poussin's facture. Quote, within the explicit structures, the local exploratory material life of procedure, of praxis, is uniquely intense. No painter, not even Giotto, has ever been so naively surprised and delighted by the sorts of equivalent a brush moving in pigment can throw up. It's from his book called The Sight of Death. For Clark, this is an indication of the kind of attention he pays to the work of art. It is the choice of the term praxis, with its overtones of material and social realities, that for me resonates with Spiro's notion of touch. Both are suggestive of a productive dialectics of the visceral and the imaginary. The long history of the relations between tactility and vision, at least in the Judeo-Christian tradition, has its originary moment in John's Gospel, 2017, and the risen Christ's response to Mary Magdalene, "Noli me tangere," don't touch me. A prohibition that allowed the gaze but denied the touch, thus preserving a necessary distance and confirming Jesus' essential otherness and immortality. Can we have the next slide, please? At a later moment, Christ breaks his own law in order to confound Thomas's skepticism, a moment captured in Caravaggio's great painting, The Incredulity of St. Thomas, 1601, which represents Christ guiding the doubting disciple's probing finger into the wound in his side, a drama of disbelief infused with a latent eroticism. To be touched is to open the body to the world, to, even if momentarily, dissolve the boundary between inside and outside, self and other, so that subjectivity, the sense and knowledge of an identifiable I, is simultaneously the not I. In this account, and it runs through the philosophies of Husserl, Merleau-Ponty, and most recently Levinas and Kristeva, alterity is the structural ground of subjecthood. This philosophical psychology contests the Cartesian tradition of inner reflection as the foundation of enlightened reason, with a conception of the embodied subject always in a relation of touching touched. All spatial and temporal experience thus flows from touch. In the act of touching someone or something, even when the object of touch is inanimate, the pressure of contact is shared. Similarly with vision, we are not only aware of being the object of another's gaze, but of the reciprocity of the visual field. Whatever or whoever we see, sees us. To return to Spiro. In performing homage to Anna Mendieta, she opens herself to an alterity that is not only the memory of loss and the body's mortality, the violent death of a close friend, inscribed in the trace of hands and arms sliding down the wall. Touch is linked to sight through the materiality of process, but also mimics Mendieta's act of embodiment with her own, a mirroring that is also a recognition of the vulnerability of the feminine in all such encounters with a monstrous other, the aggression that marks sexual difference. To quote from my own essay written for the Fiden monograph, with Anna Mendieta, voice is the body, the most primitive and universal index of identity, the handprint, becomes the allegorical scraping of blooded flesh down the wall surface, tracing a pattern of humiliation and despair. End quote. In the act of making homage, Spiro is also remembering her friend, so a history is encapsulated in the present, summarized as a trace of damaged corporeality. As the artist Kiki Smith was later remark about Spiro's practice, when I first saw Nancy Spiro's work, I thought, you're going to get killed making things like that. It is too vulnerable. However, it's important to recognize the distinction between performance, which in Judith Butler's terms presumes a subject, and performativity, which contests any notion of fixed subjectivity. Spiro pays homage to Mendieta as an artist for whom performance was a central component of her practice, a practice which located the body as the ritual construct of other systems of meaning. But Spiro also distances her own practice from generic performance art. Through a mimetic act, she places Mendieta, as it were, in parenthesis. And to confirm the performative aspect of homage, she inscribes a text across the indexical trace of the body, therefore introducing language and the symbolic realm. Her title, Homage to Anna Mendieta, thus functions in a similar manner to a performative speech act. It brings into being that which it names. In fact, a double mimicry is implied, not only in Spira's repetition of Mendieta's blood tracks, but her own paint-smeared trace down the wall mimes the action of Mendieta's body falling from the window to the street below. Actually, it's also, I suppose, worth mentioning the installation by Francesco Torres in the museum here at the moment, the piece that is called Icarus, and the text there which says that image of a falling body after 9/11 never means quite the same. Its meaning has shifted. Once we acknowledge this, meaning shifts from the indexical to the narrational, and the image suggests hands despairingly clutching empty air as gravity exerts its relentless force. Here, clearly, touch conveys something of the density of experience, of an aspect of consciousness produced through the interaction of the embodied self and the material world. Can we have the next slide, please? Other works convey the semiotics of embodiment in procedural and material effects, besides the body's symbolic figuration. The group of works known as the Black Paris paintings, a term derived from their somber tonalities and hues, and the fact that many were completed during the family's five-year period in Paris from 1959 to 1964, have densely worked surfaces that carry the trace of earlier forms, and in some, decapitated heads utter profanities, precursors of the following war series and the Artaud works. This is Lovers from 64 to 65. Can we have the next one, please? And this is Le Couple, which is 1964. And the next, please. And one of the war series, and the next. There are many of these upstairs in the exhibition. Executed in a graphic style, incorporating extreme delicacy and expressive range, with, at times, an almost physical assault upon the white ground of the paper, in some instances resulting in the actual ripping and tearing of the surface, these drawn and painted images convey the emotional testimony of the artist's response to the war in Vietnam. I want to move finally to a recent work, a work made previously for last year's Venice Biennale, but reinstalled here in Barcelona, Maypole Take No Prisoners. With this, one of her few freestanding installations, another one is Sheila Nagig at Home, which is also upstairs. Spiro repeats her familiar strategy of recoding images taken from her lexicon so that meaning shifts in their new context. They simultaneously refer back to an original source, and again we've got the image there, the war series painting, which is called Kill Commies, which is close to the Maypole. They simultaneously refer back to an original source, classical mythology, the Hebraic scriptures, popular culture, a traumatic moment in the history of women's oppression, to their narrativization in previous works or scrolls, and to their reinscription in their current format. In this case, the theme is decapitation, but here framed within the history and traditions of what was originally a pre-Christian ritual, the celebration of Beltane, literally brightness or brilliant fire, a Celtic and Saxon festival of the division of the year into two halves, a return of life and fertility to the world, and in its Roman form, an honouring of the flower goddess Flora. Maypoles and May Day celebrations became common throughout Europe from the 15th century. Briefly repressed between the Puritan Reformation and the Restoration, then re-emerging as a focus for village life and community. Traditionally made from maple, hawthorn or birch, the erection of the maypole, draped in long coloured ribbons and festooned with flowers, represented a carnivalesque rupture in the everyday patterns of social relations a period of music, dance and sexual expression. Spiro, however, does something quite different and darker with her maypole. Although the trope of decapitation, with of course his psychoanalytic overtones of castration, runs through her practice, from the already mentioned I Do Not Challenge, and a group of floating heads uttering profanities in one of the black paintings, which is also an exhibition, Les Angles Med, Fuck You, to the War series, it is in her appropriation of the poetry and prose of Antonin Artaud that they become iconic as the head with a protruding phallic tongue. The image appears repetitively, both in isolation and as an element within larger compositions. Can we have the next? This is also from the Codex Artaud. And the next, please. And again. These are heads from Torture of Women and from Notes in Time. And again. And again. Okay, this is Sky Goddess Egyptian Acrobat. A constant reminder of the silencing of a female voice with her resistance, with Nancy Spiro's resistance to that imposition. However, with Maypole, I also want to make another connection with my theme of tactility in the body. Have the next slide, please. In her book, Differencing the Canon, the art historian Griselda Pollock devotes a chapter to the painter Artemisia Gentileschi, including a discussion of Gentileschi's image of decapitation, the paintings of Judith and Holofernes, all painted between 1612 and 1620. Painting in the tradition of Caravaggio, for whom decapitation was something of an obsession, Gentileschi's paintings are read by Pollock for the signs of sexual difference, not as a revenge motive for her own rape at the hands of her teacher, Agostini Tassi, but as visual metaphors in which the literalness of killing a man is displaced onto a my theme, wherein the action is necessary, politically justified, and not personally motivated. Through making art, Gentileschi discovers forms of figuration for her own desires and achieves a kind of agency in a world controlled by men. Quoting from an essay by Hélène Cixous, Castration or Decapitation, Pollock argues that decapitation is a metaphor for the tradition of the nude in Western art, of bodies whose difference is both silenced and displayed. By subverting the normative regime of violence, switching the roles of executioner and victim, Gentileschi finds her voice. As Cixous writes, all the feminine texts I've read are very close to the voice, very close to the flesh of language. This is precisely the representational arena occupied by Nancy Spiro, with her references to foundational cultural myths and transgressive female figures and deities, to the sacred and to the profane, and to the body as both subject and object of history. A tactile female subject, tracing a path from victimization to resistance, wholeness, and freedom. The flesh of language surely also describes an artist whose touch opens a dialogue between body and voice, flesh and word, and who offers an emancipatory aesthetic formed in the imagining of other visions for our sense of embodiment and our relations with the world. Thank you.